Ladies' Home Journal was first published in 1883, and it became the first American magazine to reach a million subscribers. 2 weeks ago, all that came to an end. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, women's magazines. We'll talk about their history, what they gave to women in America when they started, how the magazines have evolved, and the stories they tell us or don't tell us about ourselves.
I want to know how people in the normal world, not a celebrity or somebody who's a model, I want to know what they're going to look like and then work they do.
We also want to hear from you. What do you love about women's magazines? And what drives you crazy? Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ladies' Home Journal was first published in 1883, and it became the first American magazine to reach a million subscribers. And that was back in 1903. 2 weeks ago, that came to an end. Meredith Corporation announced that it would no longer provide a subscription service or a monthly publication. This hour, we'll talk about the magazines that started it all, Ladies' Home Journal and the other members of what were referred to as the Seven Sisters. We'll also talk about how women's magazines have evolved and the role they play in our lives today. Later this hour, I'll talk with Brooke Birmingham, a blogger from the Quad Cities, about her struggle to get Shape Online and Shape Magazine to print a picture of her that Shape at first deemed to be too real for their readers. My first guest today is Sally Coslow. She is the former editor-in-chief of McCall's Magazine, another of the Seven Sisters publications, and McCall's discontinued publication in 2002. Sally, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Ladies' Home Journal was the first of these early women's magazines to come out, but the others followed fairly quickly after that. When these magazines first appeared, what was it that they offered women that was new?
When they first appeared, well, I don't exactly know because they are so old. They're all way over 100 years old. But I think it was a sense of community. A sense of identification. Women were far more isolated. You consider that they didn't have, think of all the ways we stay connected now, through television, through smartphones, through the internet. None of that was available to them. So a publication that reflected their interests was a wonderful new outlet.
It also gave them an opportunity to learn about what other women were doing and even sort of a social community because they were able to write letters to the magazine and interact with each other, right?
Absolutely. It was a sort of a tea party, as it were, not in the political sense, but a gathering of like-minded women. You got your magazine in the, I mean, this really was the role of magazines until quite recently. You got your issue in the mail, and I used to always picture my readers possibly taking the magazine into a bubble bath with them or sitting down on the couch after the kids went to bed at night and paging through and seeing women who stressed like them and dressed like them and had similar concerns. And it was very warm and cozy.
And of course, not all of these magazines did the same thing, but they were places where women got new ideas, whether it was about recipes or about clothing or about things to do with their children. These were places to exchange those ideas.
Right. And also issues of the day. The magazines that we're talking about always attracted top writers. Eleanor Roosevelt was a columnist at McCall's for many years, and they often published really wonderful fiction by John Steinbeck and Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. They were very elegant, beautiful art direction, usually oversized in actual size, sort of the size of what we think of today as a coffee table book. Big magazines.
Who was writing these magazines? I mean, you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt, and of course there were some amazing writers writing these magazines. Were the writers and editors women?
The editors-in-chief of the magazines were men until well into the 1970s. There's one man, real icon in our industry, John Mack Carter, who was the editor-in-chief of maybe three of them. I think it was McCall's, Ladies' Home Journal, and Good Housekeeping, which were often considered the three most distinguished and most literary of the group. The others of the Seven Sisters are Family Circle and Woman's Day, which are a little bit more practical-minded, and Better Homes and Gardens, which is still in continuation with another Meredith magazine, which was always oriented a little bit more about, as its title says, Better Homes and Gardens, which was not as much a reading magazine. But it took a shockingly long time for the magazines to be edited by women at the very top.
Yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of the articles were being written by women, which especially early in the publication of these magazines, it was rare for women to have that kind of access to the writing and thoughts of other women.
Yes, it was.
Now, there was also a lot of information. You mentioned information about cultural events, things that were going on politically, but also a lot of medical information was given through these magazines. I mean, McCall's used to regularly receive "You Saved My Life" letters, right?
Right. And that's what I feel I always felt the proudest of as an editor-in-chief of McCall's for 8 years. I always felt that women's magazines were the best way to transmit up-to-date health information, because while newspapers cover health often, it's not exclusively women's health as often as it is almost all the time in a women's magazine. And television, of course, gives sound bites on women's health often, but they're literally that. You often have to go to the website to get the full picture, whereas with a women's magazine, whether it was breast cancer or heart disease or the sad increase in diabetes or children's problems, a magazine covered it in depth with impeccably fact-checked information, and you could tear the article out and send it to your sister who might have those symptoms, or bring it to your doctor and say, you know, could this be the reason that my back aches? And we would often receive letters saying, you saved my life. It was heartwarming, but not really surprising after a while.
Well, and let's talk about what you feel that we're losing with losing Ladies' Home Journal, with losing McCall's, and these other publications. Obviously, there are still magazines out there for women, and we live in this day and age where there is so much information available. Most of us spend a lot of time on Facebook. That's how we interact with our social circle that is farther away, and actually even with people who are very nearby. There's Twitter. There are all these aggregates of information. But you have a very personal story that you published in The Atlantic Online that you were diagnosed with breast cancer about a year ago, and your doctor told you not to read about breast cancer
online. She made me promise not to read anything on the web because the coverage is so uneven. For every website that's published by, say, the Mayo Clinic with top-notch information, there might be one that's not fact-checked at all, with very scurrilous information. And the one of the good things about the web is that things can all look quite elegant and wonderful and give the impression that they're of a more serious nature than they really are. So you have to be very careful.
Now, you're a journalist. I mean, you were trained as a journalist. I would trust you to go online and look at different sources and actually be able to figure out where you can get quality information. But it sounds like that's something that you feel like we really are losing with these publications and with our shift to the virtual world is losing that kind of assurance that we can trust what we read.
Well, I do feel that way. And there's still wonderful magazines, and there are still many wonderful specialized magazines. There's some terrific women's health magazines, and specifically. But in a general way, if you're going to punch in something like, a particular kind of breast cancer, you might get some very, very scary information, which is completely not applicable at all to your case and could cause you to suffer tremendous anguish unnecessarily.
What else do you think we're losing with the evolution of women's magazines?
Well, we're losing the ability to take something into the bathtub. You don't want to really do that with your iPad. But we're we're losing a certain kind of ease that magazines required. I always thought that if the internet had come first and then someone had invented the magazine next, people would appreciate magazines a lot more, that you can tear them apart and you can take them anywhere and you can cut them up. I think things, the visuals look more beautiful printed on paper than they do on a screen, and there's a permanence to it. I mean, the news cycle, that, as we know, it is so short that something is top of mind for 48 hours, and then we're on to the next thing. There's a permanence to magazines. It's really wonderful. I feel sad that it's been a long time now since there was much fiction in magazines.
And McCall's was really famous for
its
fiction.
And Red Book and Good Housekeeping and Ladies' Home Journal. The larger, oversized magazines had wonderful fiction.
And this is fiction by really Willa Cather published fiction in magazines, right?
Yes. And because the magazines paid quite well, they were well respected. There weren't that many places for authors to publish their fiction. And there still isn't. There are very few places that publish short stories. Tiny little literary magazines, and of course, a fine magazine like The New Yorker, but there's not much in between. So that's a shame.
Now, you don't write for magazines anymore, although you still write.
I do, actually. Okay, I write essays.
You write essays
for magazines.
Oh, right,
yes.
Okay. Yeah. So not a great deal. And you are a fiction writer. You write novels as well. What magazines do you read?
Well, I still enjoy a lot of the women's magazines. I love and have subscriptions to quite a few. I always treat myself to one or two fashion magazines so that I'm not completely out of touch with what a well-dressed woman might be wearing. So at the moment I'm getting Vogue and InStyle magazine, and I think that the quality of the writing is terrific and allure. I get Food and Wine. I always have a food magazine going, and I get The New Yorker. I live in New York City, so I get New York magazine. I get Time magazine. I probably get more magazines than most people do, but then again, I'm an author, and so my default enjoyment is reading. So I love magazines, but I also read a lot of books.
Well, how do you feel about the future of magazines for women? Do you think that this is something that we will continue to have for a very long time?
Yes, but they're going to really change, and we'll be reading them more online. They'll be in different forms. I don't know what they're going to look like. They haven't looked that different in the last 10 years, which surprises me because it's almost 10 years now since I was the editor-in-chief of McCall's, and I'm really surprised when I look at magazines and see how similar they look to how they looked when I was the editor of them. But
change,
I think that they will change.
Changes on the horizon. Sally, thank you so much.
It was a delight talking to you. Thank you very much.
Sally Coslow is the former editor-in-chief of McCall's Magazine. She's now a novelist. Her fourth novel comes out in about a month. It's called The Widow Waltz. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women's magazines, with Ladies' Home Journal ceasing monthly publication, ceasing a subscription service. We're reflecting on what we might be losing with these early women's magazines going out of print. We're also going to talk about the evolution of women's magazines, and we do want to hear from you this hour. If you read women's magazines, what do you love about them? What do you hate about women's magazines? Maybe you avoid them. Is there a reason? Let us know. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And with me now is Carolyn Kitt. She's a journalism professor at Temple University and author of The Girl on the Magazine Cover. She, too, has a history with women's magazines. She used to write for Good Housekeeping and McCall's in the 1980s. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Very nice to be with you.
Now, Ladies' Home Journal, I mentioned earlier, was the first magazine in America to reach a million subscribers. That was huge, especially considering it happened in 1903. And the magazine industry was huge and became obviously even bigger than that. What does the end of Ladies' Home Journal mean economically?
Well, that's a very good question. And really, I mean, we can understand the folding of this magazine in a couple of ways. One, the thing that I think is most remarkable about it is that it is the Ladies' Home Journal really pioneered the economic model for mass circulation print media throughout the entire 20th century. And it's lasted all the way into the beginning of the 21st century, which was that you have sort of a symbiotic relationship between advertising revenue and circulation revenue. So you get lots of readers, and you can charge advertisers more money for buying space in the magazine. And the more money you get from advertisers, the better able you are to lower the price for readers, and you get more readers. And that model was really very often historians attribute the origins of this model to some other mass circulation magazines that began in the 1890s, but it really began with Ladies' Home Journal in the 1880s. And they were the first magazine to really convince national advertisers at a time of mass production, the height of the Industrial Revolution, that here was a way to reach millions of people who were, because for economic reasons, able to buy things that people didn't used to buy, you know, pianos for the home, decorating ideas, at the very same time that modern market research, audience research was beginning as well. So the loss of that now is kind of a sign, it's one of many signs that economic model is over.
Well, and in many ways, magazines, although they were so early that the advertising industry really developed with them. But even when I think about the advertising industry today, it's an advertiser's dream come true to have a very targeted audience and to have the opportunity to have an ad that you know somebody will see and look at, and it replace, or, you know, it relates to something that they're interested in, and you know that's a given.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, even in the early 20th century, magazines such as Ladies' Home Journal were targeted in their own way, and that they had a mass audience, millions of people, and yet they were one of the very few places or spaces for American women to really have a sense of what it meant to, in many cases, even be American. Some of the readers were immigrants, or they were native-born but had moved to cities, had moved to suburbs outside of cities, and were trying to figure out how do other people live. I mean, Sally Coslow brought this up in your conversation with her, that this was that women's magazines were a way for women to talk to each other, to have a sense of talking to each other. Magazines have always had an editorial voice, and the most successful magazines have a clear editorial voice. That's why women's magazines lasted for more than a century, because they spoke to readers in a way that addressed their questions about how do I decorate my house, but then how do I raise my children, and what are the issues of the day? Sally mentioned that as well, that really serious social issues and political issues were expressed to female audiences in women's magazines because no one else was addressing them.
I want to get to the phones. Karen is on the line in Nevada. Hello, Karen.
Hi. I was born in 1971, which is farther away than it used to be. And my grandmother took Good Housekeeping. And because magazines were expensive, when she finished with it, she brought it over and my mother read it. But usually before my mother got to it, I read it. And, you know, this would have been starting in about elementary school or so. And what I got out of women's magazines in the 70s and 80s was the ability to listen to conversations that adult women had and to understand the adult world in a way that I wouldn't necessarily have done, because I didn't have older sisters. I didn't have, you know, aunts that were much younger than my mother. Or even older cousins. So that was the only way, really, that I saw the adult world other than, you know, exactly what my parents were doing. You know, I remember reading the relationship stories and Hints from Heloise, and, you know, learning about how to do hair and how women did their makeup and wanting to do makeup myself, and trying out the hairstyles and finding things to cook that my mother would let me into the kitchen and do all by myself. And, you know, they were so influential to me, you know, especially Good Housekeeping, so influential to me as a child, that I think that that is something that we could really lose, you know, that view into the adult world and not keeping our children sheltered, you know, in the way that we often do now.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for your thoughts. And Carolyn, I think that Karen's experience speaks to a lot of women's experience.
Yes. Well, I should say I was an editor at Good Housekeeping for 9 years. So I'm awfully glad to hear her say that. I think that she's made a couple of really good points, that magazines were physical objects and savable objects that also were ways to sort of socially bond with your family, with your friends, and ways to sort of supplement the role model of you know, older relatives to learn how they thought, what they valued, by sort of reading your way into other women's lives. It's a really interesting social process that we now have, I think, maybe on Facebook, not quite the same way.
Well, and
we
I'm
now
thinking
have social
about
media.
There are some magazines that developed out of the women's movement in many ways that really gave young women and older women too an opportunity to look at people they considered to be role models. I'm thinking about Ms. Magazine, but also magazines like Sassy. That was so popular when I was a teenager, and it was edgier and more interesting and more intellectual than some of the other magazines for teenagers.
Yes, and the even in more traditional ways, the Seven Sisters, the traditional women's magazines, have always been platforms or spaces for, you know, nationally prominent women, including the First Lady, including the Oprah magazine. It's important that Oprah has a magazine because she is such a role model. And that's a very good example of a way in which, readers, that magazine launch was so successful because women grow up with magazines. They grow up with the behavior, they used to anyway, with the behavior of reading magazines. There's something tactile about, you know, the experience of turning the pages and there are the pictures, and it is the same voice of the role model.
I want to turn now to a much more modern magazine. We're going to talk a little bit about Shape magazine, which is one of the magazines that is serving women today. And this whole hour, of course, we're talking about women's magazines and the stories that they tell us about our lives. Brooke Birmingham lives in the Quad Cities, and starting in 2009, she began what turned into an amazing weight loss journey. She has lost over 172 pounds, and she's blogged about her experiences at brooknotonadiet.com. Recently, she was asked to share her story with Shape Online. She did an interview. She sent off before and after pictures, and that's the point where the story got complicated. Her after picture is a picture of her in a bikini. She's a thin, strong woman who bears the marks of someone who has been significantly overweight, most notably with loose skin on her belly. And Brooke, when you sent that picture off, what was the response that you got?
Well, the response I got from Shape was that they wanted me to send another photo, preferably one with my shirt on. But I had posted that picture on my website before and on my Instagram and in my Facebook page, and I've gotten a lot of great feedback from it. Everybody's always like, oh, you look so great in a bikini, you know, good for you to being comfortable in your own skin. So when I got that response from Shape, I was a little shocked.
And why is it so important for you to be seen in a bikini? I mean, Shape was going to tell your story, right? But why do you feel it's so important for such a broad audience to see this image?
For me, when I started losing weight, I had no idea what my body looked like after a massive weight loss. I had been exposed to the images that you see on different magazines. You know, I lost half my size, and you see these people in form-fitting clothes. They don't show, like, what's underneath the clothes. So in my eyes, I thought I was going to have a flat stomach. I wasn't going to deal with the issue of loose skin. I just had no idea. So I felt like I needed to start showing what a body after a massive weight loss does look like, and that it's not a flat. I don't have a flat tummy, and I have, you know, the loose skin that I deal with. But I'm still comfortable in my skin because I did this journey, and I just wanted to show that.
Was it difficult for you to accept that your body wouldn't look like the images that you've been seeing all of your life in the media?
At first, yes. I mean, I'm not stupid. I know that there are, you know, those women are photoshopped or put in, you know, different, you know, the clothes that make them look tight and thin. So I wasn't shocked at all. But I mean, at the same time, it has been difficult to deal with in the beginning.
Now, let's get back to what happened when Shape magazine said, "We want a picture of you with a shirt on." And you wrote back and you said, "No, I want to be featured in this picture. Other people are featured in bikinis," and you pushed back. And there was a lot of back and forth. You told this story on your blog, and it went viral. People everywhere, all over the world, saw this story, and it was in internet media all over the place. And then you got all of these phone calls. You were on the Today Show. You were on Good Morning America. You were on the Today Show in Australia. You were everywhere talking about this story. And you've said that you were hoping to start a conversation about this. What did you really want people to hear?
I really wanted people to, you know, not only see a body after a massive weight loss, but just a girl who's comfortable in her own skin, and the one who isn't afraid to put herself out there, and just that it's okay to look like you look. It's okay to say no to conform to the media's, you know, ideal of beauty.
And Shape magazine also has apologized to you and now has plans to feature you and other women who've been through similar journeys in a photo shoot and tell their stories. What is that going to be about? What is the focus of that?
They're going to feature me, which is great. And I told them, I was like, you're not going to do just a story on me. I want there to be other women, too, because this isn't all about me. And there's other great women who have done, you know, just what I have done, too. So it's going to be kind of just a look at not only the physical, like, aspects of a massive weight loss, but also the mental aspects of a weight loss. I mean, the physical journey is one thing, but the mental journey has been a completely another journey. And it's difficult sometimes to deal with. Like, I still deal with issues of, like, not feeling good, you know, good enough for people, or, like, get really bad anxiety about putting myself out there because I had been rejected a lot when I was overweight. So it's just kind of focusing on all aspects of a massive weight loss, which is exactly what I wanted. I want this to be out there. I want people who either have lost a lot of weight or need to lose a lot of weight to know what they're in for, or to know that they're not alone in their journey.
You do see real bodies in the before and after stories, but in the articles about different things you can do to get in shape or how to have the perfect bot or, you know, all of those stories, the images of women that I see are so incredibly fit and so perfect that for most of us, that is unattainable. How do you feel about the fact that those are the images that we see even in the magazines that we're turning to and we want to be healthy and confident and strong?
I find it really, you know, frustrating. And that's honestly, I don't buy a lot of fitness magazines for that reason. Because I, you know, like, I'm a real person. I want to know how, like, people in the normal world, not a celebrity or somebody who's a model, I want to know what they're going to look like and the work they do, which is one reason why I started a blog. And another reason why I read all of these amazing blogs, because, I mean, those are, you know, real people who are doing this for real. They don't, you know, they don't have a personal trainer. They don't have a personal chef. These are the ones putting in the work and talking about, like, the real story.
When your story gets out there in Shape magazine, what do you hope people take away from it?
I hope people start to realize that they can do this. They can lose a massive amount of weight if they need to. That they can, you know, that if they have lost a massive amount of weight, that they're not alone in their journey, that, you know, we all look like this. We've all dealt with these things. And I hope that it just gives other women the inspiration to feel comfortable in their own.
Do you also hope that people start thinking about a weight loss journey as about more than what you look like in the after picture? Because clearly, I mean, Brooke, you have added years to your life. I can only imagine that your energy level has changed. You're so much stronger. Clearly, you're more confident. Do you want to tell that side of the story, too?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, yes, I fit into smaller clothes. Yes, I look good in a bikini. Yes, that is great. But that's nothing compared to the fact that I can ride my bike for miles upon miles. I can run if I want to. My blood pressure is normal. My resting heart rate is that of an athlete. You know, like, that aspects of those things are way bigger than what I look like. And, you know, I tell people, with every pound of loss, I gained a pound of confidence. And it's true.
Brooke, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Brooke Birmingham shares her weight loss journey on her website, brookenotonadiet.com. That's B-R-O-O-K-E, notonadiet.com. And her story will be featured in Shape magazine. And we're continuing our conversation about women's magazines today, how women's magazines have evolved since the turn of the 20th century. Carolyn Kitch is with me. She is a journalism professor at Temple University and the author of The Girl on the Magazine Cover. She's also written for women's magazines. She used to write for Good Housekeeping in the 1980s. And we're going to talk a lot about the images that we see in these magazines, whether it's in advertising or in articles. And of course, we want to hear from you, too. There's quite a conversation going on Facebook about these images. You can post on our page, Iowa Public Radio. You can also email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or, of course, you can join the conversation on the telephone. The number to call is 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women's magazines, how they've evolved, the place that they serve in our lives today. And of course, we want to hear from you, too. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. I'm with Carolyn Kitch. She's a journalism professor at Temple University and the author of The Girl on the Magazine Cover. And Carolyn, we were just talking with Brooke Birmingham about some of the images that we see in these magazines. And we've gotten a lot of response about that. Here's a comment from Kathy, who said, I don't even like having them where my kids can see them, especially with my daughter, 15 years old, and my son, who's 13 years old. Even though they're both athletic and I hope have good body images, from many conversations over the years with both me and their dad, those magazines only promote perfect, and that is just not realistic. Now, of course, in the early years, the pictures in magazines, of course, weren't photoshopped and retouched, but they still often represented this image of perfection, whether it was the home or the woman herself, didn't they?
Well, yes, they weren't photographs; they were illustrations. And women's magazines, in particular, this is true of the magazine industry in general, but in particular, women's magazines continued to use illustrations on their covers well after it was possible to print color photography on magazine covers, and that's because the images were ideals. They were types of beauty, and they very often were scenes. They weren't simply an image, and I'm talking, you know, through the 1950s or 1960s. So from the 1890s to the 1960s, a long time, what you were likely to see on the cover of a magazine was an illustration, or perhaps in the 50s and 60s, a photo of a woman who represented the typical reader, not a celebrity yet. That was a change that happened in the 1970s, but a typical looking, obviously an aspirational, a woman who looked fit and happy, but usually doing something, often shown with children, sometimes shown with other women in a situation. So the cover image changed over the century from sort of scenes of doing to scenes of being. And then in the 70s, because of the success of People magazine, which was launched in 72 or 73, lots of magazines, including the news magazines, switched to using celebrities on the covers.
And these images, as I mentioned, of course, went from being beautiful, ideal images to being beautiful, ideal images that didn't actually represent reality because, of course, they have all been photoshopped.
I think that, there was no Photoshop until fairly.
Right.
I mean,
right.
if you take a historical view and you're looking back for a century, Photoshopping is a recent
right.
Phenomenon.
I'm talking about today with the images mm-hmm. that we see. I mean, so many of
yes.
them have been altered, and I know it's not 100% of publications that do it, but it's very nearly that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I would say it probably is 100%. Not necessarily for reasons of falsely altering the way people look, but for reasons of lighting and, you know, things that get into pictures that shouldn't be there, like flies. I mean, it's possible to make pictures, to make images more visually perfect, and this is important in a magazine that is primarily visual. So,
right.
I think it probably is 100% as a phenomenon right now.
Let's go back to the phones. Lynn is on the line. Hello, Lynn.
Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, let me see here. I've been jotting down some notes. And one thing that I want to talk about is kind of in line with those fitness magazines. But overall, I've realized that I come from a background with poverty. I've never been able to make a substantially successful income for myself, and I realized that my love for magazines was actually feeding a fantasy of a life that just is not going to exist. And so I basically have just quit buying subscriptions, and I buy just a magazine once in a while.
So you felt like it was actually causing you to have unrealistic expectations for yourself
right.
and your own life?
And seriously, a lot of depression from knowing that I'm never going to be that person in that picture. I'm not going to be on the beach with the kids. There's not going to be Halloween parties. There's not going to be dinner parties. There's not going to be a guest bedroom. There's not going to be barbecues. There's not going to be the beautiful gardens. I had even told a girlfriend, I said, I've realized that if a doctor's wife has a dilapidated shed in her yard covered with ivy, it is seen as rustic and charming. But in a tough neighborhood, to have that in your yard, you're going to be getting a letter from the city to tear that down because it's considered an eyesore. So that location.
Right. So Lynn, you went from enjoying these magazines to really resenting them.
Kind of. And then along with the gal who said they had lost all that weight, I had always been somebody who was very slender and extremely athletic looking. With a mother who constantly cut down my appearance for having a boyish athletic figure.
Hmm.
I had an unreal metabolism, and we did not have much money for food, so I used babysitting money to buy my own groceries, and anybody who would let me fill up my coat with apples, I would do so. And so I went from being a severe asthmatic, it quieted down, and I didn't own a car till I was 25, so in college I walked, I rode my bicycle everywhere. If I had a doctor's appointment 10 miles away, I was on my bike. And so I had always thought that I was gross to look at. I had a 24-inch waist.
Mm.
And just thought that I was ugly because of my mom's remarks about me.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Well, what I just wanted to say, that when I saw a fitness magazine saying a size 10 was considered a plus size body, I had just won a bodybuilding trophy at a size 10. And I just thought, what? How can they do this to women?
Well, Lynn, again, thank you so much for sharing your story today. And Carolyn, the images that Lynn brings up something kind of interesting that you found in your research, and that's how the images that we see in women's magazines have changed over time and reflect even the economy that we're experiencing right now. What have you seen reflected on women's magazines because of economic conditions in the country?
Well, historically, I have kind of a double answer to that, and it seems to be contradictory. In one sense, at any given time, there is a certain and limited number of types of beauty or, you know, ideal looks, ranging from maternal to, you know, girlish a modern, sleek version of the new woman. They all exist in every time period, and they're all in circulation and culture at the same time. What varies is which one is emphasized. Very often that corresponds to other things that are happening in, at that time, you know, during the women's movement in both the 1910s and 20s when women got the vote, and then again in the 60s and 70s, the height of the second wave of the American women's movement, the images went girlish again, which is kind of, you know, people talk about a backlash against women's rights. It was in play at the same time. If you think of, you know, the flapper in the teens and 20s and Twiggy in the 60s and 70s, visual images ran counter to women's actual political strength.
Interesting.
Also in bad times, however, bigger bodies come back into fashion, which is, you know, and during the Great Depression, or at any rate, curvaceous bodies. I think we can see that in, you know, we're in a bad economy right now, and there are certainly a number of fictional but idealized representations of women in celebrity culture who have curves. So body type is often a sign of other things that are going on in the culture.
Now, we can blame these magazines for showing us unrealistic images or say that they're steering us in an unrealistic direction. But you also mentioned earlier that these women's magazines were really the beginning of market research.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that people have gotten extraordinarily good at market research today. Are we seeing images because that's what we want to see?
The early market research, by the way, it was Ladies' Home Journal that began. The company that owned Ladies' Home Journal, the Curtis Publishing Company, which was then in Philadelphia, owned not only Ladies' Home Journal but also the Saturday Evening Post, which was the first magazine to hit 2 million in 1918, and they created the first model for modern market research. Their interest was less in images of what people look like than in what they bought. And in what their aspirations were in terms of lifestyle and class, which is an interesting aspect that your last caller brought up. Magazines always have been an aspirational medium, and by that I mean the presumption is people are reading them to dream, you know, of what might be. And your caller said, you know, she discovered that you know, life didn't work out that way,
mm-hmm.
and so it is. You know, it can be false hope, but again, and in good economic times, when people are, you know, after World War II, when people like my parents, you know, built a home, they never would have been homeowners. I also grew up very working class, you know, bought stuff that their parents never would have bought, and I'm sure that my mother was looking in magazines for ideas of how to make this house. So that's what market research has been about as well.
Now, of course, you used to work for some of these women's magazines,
mm-hmm.
and I talked to Sally Coswillow who was the former editor-in-chief of McCall's. There's been a change in who is writing for these magazines today. And of course, we've seen this reflected all over journalism, where there is a great deal more reliance on young journalists or even mm-hmm. freelance journalists. And that's one of the things that comes out of this Shape story that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And that's that the editor-in-chief of Shape magazine said, oh, the person who told you that they wouldn't publish that picture was just a freelancer, and she got it all wrong. And, you know, that's not our policy, and now they're moving forward. But it does make me wonder how the journalistic standards of these magazines have changed when we're depending on people without that much oversight or without that much experience for the mm-hmm. content in the magazines.
Yes, as an economic question as well. It has to do with the financial structure of the magazine industry and the newspaper industry as well. I teach journalism now, and we see this, you know, with our students in internships, our students going out. I have a former student who is at a major magazine in New York, and I'm not going to say which one. And basically, he has a contract to work full-time without benefits. and this is a kind of standard in the media industries, not only in the magazine business, that there are these sort of half jobs that are not really jobs and are contracts. So it's almost like an advanced internship. I'm not sure that that necessarily means that they're untrained. It just means that they're young, and that the quality of their training and the quality of their intelligence, I think, varies in the same way it does with the population. You have some really terrific. You mentioned Sassy Magazine that was launched by Jane Pratt, with whom I was an assistant editor at McCall's. And she was 24 years old. She was the editor-in-chief, or maybe 25, and she did a great job. So structurally what's also changed is that copy editors and fact checkers don't exist anymore. And that is, I think, a bigger issue, that the sort of the middle levels of editorial positions have gone away in newspapers as well as magazines. And so happens.
It also makes me wonder, in this situation, I mean, I don't know the specifics, so I can't say who's at fault or anything of those lines. But, you know, there is the blame the intern syndrome. Yeah. And these freelancers are disposable in some ways. Yeah. You pin the blame on one and you let them go.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, that's true. I want to add something about gender. And you mentioned this. Sally Coslow said it took a shockingly long time for all of the women's magazines to be edited entirely by women. I actually worked for the last two male editors-in-chief of women's magazines, and they were Bob Stein at McCall's and John Matt Carter at Good Housekeeping. And John left in 1995.
Wow.
I was still in the business in the 90s as well. And 1995, that's how long it took.
Wow, that's interesting. So what do you read today? Where do you go for this kind of information?
For what kind of information?
For the kinds of things that you would find in women's magazines, if that's something you're interested in.
Yeah. Well, being a journalism professor, and it's true, and Sally Coslow said the same thing. You know, she's immersed in the magazine industry. I see a lot of things without necessarily – I get a lot of things without necessarily going to the newsstand and making the choice, the conscious choice. I tend to buy magazines for the things that they offer that other I can't get from other media. And that's not necessarily information. It is when something big happens, you know, when there's an anniversary of something or there is a major event, I'll go out and buy magazines because I want to save them because they're physical things that get saved. And I also really enjoy the visual aspects of, you know, for instance, Vanity Fair or sometimes, decorating magazines or design magazines. So I think I'm more attracted to magazines for the pictures and the savability, and that varies with their theme.
With places like Pinterest and AllRecipes.com, mm-hmm. and I mean, there are so many places now to exchange ideas about fitness, about fashion, about homemaking, about food. Is there a future for women's magazines?
I think when you have a very strong editorial voice and a very strong following, and again, the Oprah magazine is a good example. When that connection holds and people will buy, you know, whatever the brand is, whatever the voice is, and I think we see it with cooking magazines as well right now, because the fact that, you know, there's a food network, which I'm addicted to, and people sort of form relationships with the celebrity chefs, and then they go buy their magazines. I think to the extent to which there are relationships and they hold, the magazine industry will continue.
Carolyn Kitch, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carolyn Kitch is a journalism professor at Temple University and author of The Girl on the Magazine Cover. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. With me now, Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Charity. A new Humane Society's May 2014 report includes six problem puppy breeders in Iowa. I didn't know this. Iowa has the second largest number of large-scale commercial dog breeding facilities in the country. We'll talk about problems, people having concerns about those today on our program. We'd like to hear about people's experiences with questionable breeders over the noon hour.
All right. That's today on River to River at 12 o'clock. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, a conversation with comedian Mike Birbiglia.